Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
All right, Entree Architect community, it's time for context and clarity. The reason that I come to you every day is so that we can find clarity around the things that matter most to you, the architect. And it doesn't matter if you're the employee of a firm. Maybe you dream of starting your own firm. Maybe you even said 2021 is my year and you're on the runway to starting your own firm. Maybe you've had a firm for a year or 10 years or 20 years and you're starting to rethink, reimagine what your firm could or should be. All of the topics that we cover, one topic every day, fall under the broad umbrella of the business of architecture, and they are the need-to-know topics for the success of architects just like you.
My Facebook community, Entree Architect community, LinkedIn community, Twitch, all the architects out there on Twitch. It's 4 p.m. Eastern, which means it's time for Context and Clarity Live. Thank you for joining us today. I'm here again, as usual, on Thursday afternoons, joined by my co-host, Catherine McPhail. Hi, Catherine. How are you?
Great. How are you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing all right. Good. Testing the technology out today. We're trying to break the internet again this week. So
we broke it at my house.
So here's a little fun fact. 2 days in a row now, we have lost power completely in our neighborhood. And of course, you want to find out why you've lost power. I think we paid our bill. And as it turns out, 2 days in a row, there have been accidents where someone has run into a pole and knocked the power line down. So I don't know what the deal is driving in Indianapolis. But
is it icy or anything? Or
not today. It has been, but not the last two days.
That's not it then.
Yeah, I don't know. We've got a few people rolling in. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. As you roll in, again, if you joined us last week, if you're on Facebook, we're a little bit challenged. We're going to try to say hi, if we can, by name. We see you. You can see the comments and questions up on the screen today, which is a great thing. I like that. But for everybody that's out there on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on YouTube or on Twitch, welcome to Context and Clarity Live. I think we've got an exciting conversation lined up today. We're going to have another special guest today, as we do now every Thursday afternoon. And the topic that we're going to discuss today, once we get into it, is technology and architecture. We're going to ask questions like, how is technology changing the practice of architecture? Who's driving that change, perhaps, is a question that we will address as well. And so as we get into this, number one, get ready for the conversation with our special guest, who I'll introduce here in just a minute. But think about what's going on in your firm. What is challenging you? Is there technology that's entering the profession that you're afraid of, that's scaring you right now, that you're concerned about? We want to know what your questions are. Catherine is really good at combing through the comments and looking for those questions. We're going to get them in front of our guests today, and that'll help us drive the conversation today. So again, thank you for joining us. As you come in, say hi, let us know that you're here. Thank you to the Facebook users who have done us the favor of self-identifying. I really appreciate that. So we see you, Tim. We see you, Barry, John, Kenny, all of you. Margarita, I see you over there on LinkedIn. So thanks for joining us. Again, we are streaming everywhere all across the internet. So hope to have lots of friends joining us here today. What do you think about this technology, Catherine?
Oh, well, I don't know. You keep saying I'm good at it, which is increasing the pressure, I feel like. Now I'm really going to mess it up. But I appreciate when people do put their initials. So JFK, I know who you are. Tim, you can just put TD. So I'll try to keep up with who's out there just by the initials. That'll be my job.
It's one of the great things about these conversations. There's Brian McCartney over there on LinkedIn. Hi, Brian. Thanks for joining us. Portland, Maine must be Mike Maine's. I recognize the location at least. One of the great things about context and clarity, we've been hosting this show starting inside the Entree Architect Community Facebook group on April 6, 2020. So John Kinney's got to remind me, what is it, Saturday, John? I think it'll be 10 months of context and clarity. Now, every Thursday afternoon, we're breaking outside of the walls of the community there in Facebook. But I know that we'll still have a large part of our community there inside the Entree Architect group. But it's also... I think it's also really interesting to be able to meet people where they are. Nikita Morell is down under. She's in Australia. Hi, Nikita, from over there on LinkedIn. Great to have you. That's one of the reasons. Nikita is one of the reasons that we wanted to expand this conversation outside of the Facebook group, bring in a special guest so that we could dig deeper into some of the most popular topics of context and clarity. And just see where this conversation goes. So I'm excited about it. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
So am I.
Should we introduce our guest?
Yes.
He's over there.
I see him. He looks ready.
I think he is ready.
Yeah.
I think he is. Some of you are going to know this guest. Some of you have actually read the post and read the announcement, so you already know who the guest is. But Evan Troxell, who is our guest, I'm going to pull Evan out of the green room. Hi, Evan.
Hey, everybody.
Evan's no stranger to the Entree Architect community. He's a member. He's a longtime face around the parts of architecture and the Entree Architect community. He's an architect. He's been in the world of architecture, the practice of architecture, for a few years. About what? Over two decades, right?
Just a few, yeah.
Yeah. Evan's old like me. Much older than Catherine is. And
I'm older than you, just for the record, Jeff. I just want to own that because I've been working on it all this time. Hey,
if you want to own it, you can have it.
That's it. I'm older than
yours.
I said it.
Right. So, all right.
I guess older than Evan too. I mean, not that we're talking about that today, but
well, we're not, but that's all right. We've got three old people on the line today. But the great thing is Evan is an architect. Evan works in an architecture firm. However, he's the director of digital practice in the firm where he is, over at HMC Architects. How many employees are at HMC these days, Evan?
It's a good question. I think it's around 335, 350, something like that.
Okay. So not a small firm, not a giant, but not a small firm at all.
Right.
And Evan is in charge of their digital practice over there. He is also co-founder and co-host of the ArchSpeak podcast, which I'm sure most of you have heard of, if not all of you. And starting last year, he launched a new podcast to the host called Troxell. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, that's it.
Troxell. And you can find Troxell and ArchSpeak wherever you consume podcasts. Or you can go to GableMedia.com, GABLmedia.com, which is the home of Troxell. It's the home of ArchSpeak. It's the home of the Entree Architect podcast, the Build Your Brand, a handful of other podcasts, plus a couple of video channels now. So if you're looking for media to consume, especially focused on the built environment, GableMedia.com, GABLmedia.com is a great place to go. And like I said, you can find both of Evan's podcasts over there. You can also find now the new daily Context and Clarity podcast. So spend 5 minutes with your coffee every morning and get a review or an update on what we talked about yesterday and a preview of what we're going to talk about today. That's why we started that particular podcast. So Context and Clarity is over there on Gable, as well as everywhere Everywhere, just everywhere. Just everywhere. Yep. Welcome, Evan. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great.
So when we think about technology, when I was recording the podcast episode for today, I started thinking about my career. You know, I graduated. When did I graduate? I graduated in 92, I think. Or 93, I guess. Did my internship in 92. The firm, Catherine and I talked about this the other day, the firm that I worked for, the two architecture partners went to IIT in Chicago, and they had Mies van der Rohe as their professor. Okay. So these weren't young guys, even back then. And I am convinced that I was hired because I knew how to turn on the one computer that they had in the office.
Yeah, I used to be able to go to my grandparents' house and set the clock on the VCR. That's
there you go.
Yeah,
that's awesome. So
that's hard to do, actually.
It was.
Yeah,
yeah. I especially felt smart.
Today. Yeah, you've got to find the cord for the VCR if you're going to do it today.
No, they're wireless. Yeah.
Oh. Okay. We've come a long way, right?
See, from technology, right there.
Right there, from being hired because you can turn a computer on to whatever it is that you're doing at HMC, you know, whatever the cutting edge is, that's a big gap. That's a lot of change.
It is.
And you talk about these types of things on Troxel with super interesting guests and super interesting conversations. What do you see? How would you quantify maybe the speed of change? Can you do that? Can you look back and go, okay, this is where we were. This is how far we've come. This is where we're headed. The acceleration, how fast it's going. What do you think about the speed of change?
Everyone's probably sick of hearing me say this, but there's two things that architects hate. And those two things are the way things are and change. And we are in the middle of that all the time. Right. So some days it feels like everything's frozen over and you're walking through molasses, and other days feels like you're moving at light speed. And so because it's all kind of happening at the same time, that's a really hard question to answer, because in some ways I can look at a transformation like the one that our firm went through earlier last year to basically get 350 offices up and running over the course of a week. From seven physical offices, right, to trying to get architects to use a smarter tool because it will provide further benefit and value in the future versus the short-term payoff that you might get by using an older tool today because you're so well-versed in it and so comfortable with it. That's a really hard change to make. That change management is incredibly difficult to make because it's you're fighting kind of human nature at that point, right? People are really wanting to feel like they're in control, and learning new tools means you are not in control at some level, right? It's a painful process to go through. So it's all over the map. And I would have to say, in a firm like ours, we've never seen so much change in such a short period of time as in the last 18 months to 2 years. So before pandemic times as well. But at the same time, like, we have so far to go. There's just an institution of that size with that many departments and people and processes and workflows and standards that have been around for a very long time, take a very long time to change.
Evan, I have kind of a relevant question that came in. Did you invent the position that you have at your firm now? And is your realm just building production, or is it like management software and every part of technology?
It's technology as it relates to the practice of architecture. So it's not IT type stuff that my department is doing. And it is an overhead department. And it kind of takes, I think that's what it actually took, at least in our institution, to make it work, because it can't be somebody's side job. It has to be something that people are dedicated to and that the company dedicates resources to do. And it can't be something where, you know, because if I'm a senior project designer, as I was before I took on this role and basically created this department and the structure and everything, if a project deadline is there, that is what gets all of your attention, no matter what, right?
Right.
That's no different in any firm. So no matter what the size is either. So if you can't fully focus on digital transformational change within the company 100%, it's very hard to do. So that's why we instituted it in the way that we did.
Okay. That makes sense.
And I think coming at it as a design problem, as an architectural designer for so long, really helped me, because I'm really comfortable with it being a messy process, like so many architects are. We start with a blank page. We design a building based on a program. It could go a million different directions. It all depends on who's involved. I think that, you know, creating this department in our firm was very similar to that process. And being able to communicate, as designers do have to, and engage clients and different stakeholders throughout the process, I basically turned that inward to our firm and treated it like that process throughout the life cycle of creating it.
That's really interesting. You know, you've mentioned several different things. I mean, human nature, obviously.
That's the hardest part. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of humans involved, and there's a lot of messy. You know, humans are messy, and there's a lot of mess involved. So, but I think a lot of times, at least when I think about technology, I might think of, well, AI, which maybe we'll touch on AI or AR or BIM or whatever. And several people, I'm watching the comments a little bit, and several people mentioned pencils. And back to the story of my internship, 99.9% of what we did was with pencils or ink even. Yeah. And John Kenny mentioned teletype. But it's not even just the tools, right? And you mentioned this, it's processes, it's systems.
It's the culture.
That's a really good point.
Right.
Really good point.
We made a big intentional decision to affect the culture of the firm and interweave technology in as many threads through that as we could, so that there became a vocabulary and a consistency throughout the staff of the firm. It was very intentional to affect the culture and not just be a group within the larger company, but we call it digital practice. And the way that I position that is, well, eventually this is just going to be practice. This is what everybody's going to do. We're just calling it something now so that we know that what we're talking about. But eventually this is just the new skill set for the future of this firm. And it won't be called digital practice then. It'll just be how we practice.
So I have a question about, you said in the last 18 months, I think you said everything has changed with 3 years to 18 months. What what started that change? What happened that? Was there some new?
It was, I had a slowdown in my project work, and I have always been kind of a technologist in the architectural field. I taught emerging technology at the local university in the architecture department for over a decade. And so I've always kind of had this is my specialty. This is my passion. I know that it can help us do things that we can imagine, right? And I really just have a passion for that. And I identified an enormous hole. Like our BIM support group was literally just that, right? It was like, how do you fix my Revit model today because it's crashing? And it was much more reactionary. And I wanted to create something much more proactive about the future of the company. And so I just started having those conversations as much as I could with the CEO and the senior leadership group in until we got to a point where they really understood the vision of what could be. And we created an entire new group that supports the entire firm in that way.
Okay. So it was no new invention that spurred. It was just your time that you dedicated to.
And lots of firms have done this. Yeah. So it wasn't like we were just inventing a new thing for us. Yeah.
Okay.
That's interesting. And to me, it's also interesting that, you know, you're talking about a firm of 300 plus people. Now I fully recognize that many of the people in the audience today may be in small firms or definitely smaller than 300. Maybe we have some from larger firms as well, but we've got a couple in the audience. I saw John Kenny and I see Christian. They're both there. They're both focused on, forgive me both for saying it this way, but on the production side, John is very focused on systems and templates, and Christian is providing services for other architects. So they are using the tools or applying the tools. I know John, and I think he's even mentioned in a comment here already, talking about you know how to implement these tools. And you used the word culture a minute ago, which I think is has to be key to the success that you've had so far.
Yeah.
But I also wonder if someone is sitting going, and I say, Leslie, I see you, Leslie solo. Mm-hmm. If someone's going, well, you know, I'm a one person or a three person firm, and Evan's in a 300 person firm. Mm-hmm. Is there a huge difference other than scale, obviously, but is there a huge difference? Can a one or three person firm exist, do the things that you're talking about without actually implementing their own small culture to do the same thing?
I mean, absolutely. It's kind of the same thing. And I don't think that the scale matters. If there, a question came up on Twitter the other day where George Valdez over at Monograph HQ mm-hmm. posed the question, what would you like to see in a project template? And some people immediately start thinking what production tools are using. I think he's thinking of it from a bigger scope. How do we approach doing project work? Do we systematize that enough? And my response was, I can't believe we're still talking about this. I mean, honestly, we are still talking about this. But if you're a one person firm or a 300 person firm, the more things that you can systematize, the more things, more expertise that you can codify into blocks that you can apply to every single project or nearly every single project, lets you focus on stuff that's way more important as an architect and the things that you can do that are that make your projects different from, you know, just a contractor doing it instead of a owner engaging an architect to make it a reality. I would rather focus on the design part. I would rather focus on the inspiration part. I would rather focus on the special parts and never draw certain kinds of details again and never lay out parking again and never lay out a toilet room again in a school, right? For instance. So I think that the things that we find ourselves doing over and over and over again, it's amazing to me that we use every project. We can actually justify it on every single project to draw all that stuff every single time. But that's a choice. And so we have to realize that that's a choice. And some people, I think, are very comfortable doing that stuff. And then there's other people who see the possibility of not having to do that stuff and all of the things you can do, spend that time on instead. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I got to the heart of your question about culture there, but I think, you know, from a fundamental level, I think there's a lot of people who look at standards and templates and things as handcuffs. And I actually look at them as freedom.
So I was kind of wondering what exactly we're talking about when you're saying adopting a new technology. So you're talking about like new like BIM software? Are you talking about just using the templates or what one of your guests was talking about recently about computers that could think for themselves when it comes to laying out offices or school buildings? And what kind of technology are you talking about in your firm?
Yeah, I think for the most part, it's not like the typical features that you're talking about in Revit that we're talking about. We're talking about more, it's a terrible word to use, but more bespoke kind of solutions to these kinds of problems.
That's like anti-technology word right there.
There's a lot of companies out there focusing on really special tools that do one thing really well. Which is kind of very different from the way Autodesk would approach a problem, which is we're going to make the thing that does everything, but none of it really well, right? And a lot of that comes down to the users for sure. And like how much they know about the tool and how to use it. Because that's an unfair generalization because there's definitely, you can do so many things in the platform. And most people think that a lot of those things aren't possible in those platforms. But now there's this new kind of class of platforms that is not trying to solve the whole thing, that can do really interesting, fast, and iterative work that you can't do without it. Like you could come up with three schemes in the course of a week for a client. But a computer can come up with a lot more than that, right? And it doesn't mean they're good. Like, most of them are bad, actually. But and it's not, I'm not trying to make an argument for generative design, but that's the kind of tools I'm talking about, Leslie or Catherine. So if you're actually thinking like, what are these things we're talking about? It's generative design tools. It's environmental analysis tools. It's what real-time rendering tools. It's VR. It's things that put clients in their space so that they can experience it before it gets built and really understand it. Whereas it's really hard for them to understand a set of drawings, right? Yeah. So that kind of stuff.
I think that's a really important point. And a lot of what you were just talking about gets to, I see a question from Hans on the screen about general tech approach versus early adopter, et cetera. And I think you explained that really well. It's the things that you need. And I like the purpose. And this is one thing that I've wondered about for years. When architects, and I don't want to throw architects under the bus, but you know, this is part of the conversation. You know, I drew this elevation. We've got all these elevations. We've got all these plans, and the client was still surprised when whatever, you know, don't they understand, you know, they may not get quite to that level, but isn't that the job, right? Isn't it the responsibility of the architect to convey in whatever means necessary, this is what the space is going to look like. It's going to feel like it's going to be like, this is how you're going to use it. And to me, it's now you have incredible tools at your disposal to convey that.
Mm. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's the way that we've always approached this at Digital Practice at HMC is it's very much like a Venn diagram in that all of these things that we're doing are connected and we have to do them all at the same time. So while we can be working on standards and templates and all of those kinds of things to make the day-to-day mundane stuff so that somebody doesn't have to think about it, we also want to be working on the stuff that is aspirational and directional and really how architecture can affect people on the highest levels. And so you've got to find a balance and kind of do it all there if you really want to be successful with it, because there's some people who are going to speak that efficiency productivity language in the firm. And there's other people who are like, I don't care about that. I want to change the world. And it's coming up with a balance in those things and really trying to fire on all cylinders at once to make that happen for the firm to be successful in the future. Because I've adopted the thinking that we're never going to outdraw a contractor, like working at the scale of buildings that we work at. You know, how many times have we done a set of details that they never even look at, right? What was the point? Well, the purpose for us was to get it through the agency. The agency wanted to see that. It's been like with the stuff that we're doing, public work, you know, Department of State Architect wants to make sure that your fastener detail is, you know, tested properly, that you're calling out for the right fasteners and spacing and all that kind of stuff. Contractor doesn't necessarily care about those things, right? So we're putting information into a model to spit out a set of drawings to get a permit. And then the contractor takes that model and says, what am I supposed to do with this? Right? So we're saying, use the drawings. We're actually saying, don't measure off the model. The model is a byproduct of getting us to this finish line. And you can see how this future of what is the future of deliverables is a big, wide open question, right? Because we're still delivering drawings and we're saying you can't use the model. And everybody's saying, but we want to use the model because it's all the information is already there, right? And there's a complete mismatch of expectations and what we need to produce for a contractor to take that to then build it are two completely different things.
That's interesting. And it opens up that question. And it puts a different spin on this question than I was expecting, I guess, on one level. You know, who's driving not only the technology, but who's driving the purpose and the expectation of the technology? I mean, you just listed off several things right there that I think is great. You've got one expectation from the contractor, one expectation from the agency, another in-house. And then another perhaps from the client side. That's a really interesting state.
Yeah. And we also internally have kind of a, an arm wrestling match of what is the purpose of the model. And I mean, the true answer is it's probably 10 different things, right? It's visualization. It's to create construction documents. It's for energy modeling. It's for environmental analysis. It's for visualization. It's for BIM. It's for all these different, it's for quantity takeoffs. And I think typical architects or typical design team workers think about it as, what does it mean to me? And they're not thinking about it as that larger, because it actually can be the same model for all those things, but everybody has to understand that and ask the question, what do you need from me in this model to do what you need to do with it? Rather than, I'm only going to do what I care about, which is what's going to show up on A3.2, right?
Hmm. You know, someone just asked a question of whether they think that your position could work on a retail level so that someone could be someone like you servicing one person firms, like 500 one person firms with emerging mm-hmm. technologies. Do you think mm-hmm. you think that would be a possibility, or is that like just a like a Revit rep, or what does that look like?
No, I think that's a platform. I think that's a fantastic opportunity for somebody to come along and create a platform that will kind of band together the resources of all of these disparate practices out there and give them some leverage in the technology space so that they could share resources and also help create standards so they don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. I mean, that's actually one of the fundamental ideas behind a technology company that I'm really excited about, which is HYPAR. If you look up HYPAR, HYPAR.io, their thesis statement is architecture shouldn't have to start from the blank page. And so if we start to codify expertise, if every firm out there took a different piece of the puzzle and made it into a chunk of code that can then run as a function in line or in parallel with other functions to create a hospital. So if I'm an expert in ORs and somebody else is an expert in outpatient and that all needs to go in the same building, I could throw those different functions in there and I don't have to be an expert in all of them, but yet we approach every single project like that. We're going to start from scratch, or maybe the client has a template for a certain type of space that we're going to plug in, but everything else is going to be custom. I think that there's huge opportunities for platforms where architects can band together as a profession to stop having to start from a blank page every time and really leverage each other's knowledge and trust that so that we can move forward together as a profession. There's so much, the competition is bred so deep within us from such an early age, and we never let go of that. And I think it has really held our profession back.
That's a really interesting idea. And I think, you know, I know there's going to be some tension there, right? There's the competitiveness, et cetera. There's the design, right? Everybody's, you know, they're drooling. I want to design. There's that aspect of it.
And yet we design toilet rooms over and over and over again. And exactly. I'm not saying that that's not design, because obviously there's design in all phases of a project, but design is not a phase. That's a good saying. But if you really want to design, if you really want to compete, you should be competing on design. You should not be competing on all of this stuff that you do on every single project that just fills time, because all we do is sell time, right? So if I want to sell valuable time with valuable outcomes, I want to put my brain power towards the stuff that really inspires in a meaningful way the communities that we live in, and not the stupid stuff like parking layouts.
Yeah. One of the first things that you said in this conversation today is that these are my words, not your words, but basically we've built in the ability in our fee to design, to draw and design and detail all of these things every single time.
Yeah.
But to your point, and you know, one of the things that we talk about in the Entree Architect environment a lot of time is how do we build stronger, more profitable practices? Why would you? Right. Yeah. Why would you, just to exactly to your point, why would you every single time do a new parking layout? Yeah. Because that's, even though it's in there in the budget, why is that? Yeah. Is that time spent on the parking layout, or is it profit loss?
Well, and I would say it's bad for your morale. right? It's bad for your professional outlook, right? If like what you want to do, things that get you up in the morning and get you to want to do the work. And I don't think it's that stuff.
Right. Well, not in my experience, maybe for somebody, I don't know. So architects banding together, a platform where somebody has the OR expertise and somebody has the outpatient expertise. We've got templates, we've got systems. How far are we? What's the leap from that point? And we've talked about generative design. At what point does the technology start taking some of the scope away from us? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess it just depends how you think about it. It already is taking some of that scope. I hope it's taking some away. Like HMC published a parking lot script on HIPAR so that you never have to design a parking lot again, right? So, and seriously, like you can go through five iterations of a parking lot by moving a slider and you pick the one you like, and it's gets you 90% of the way there. It doesn't solve every possible thing, like where the trash enclosure goes and if you've got eight exits instead of three. But it's enough, and it tells you how many parking spots are there, and it tells you the lot coverage, and it tells you how many trees are there in the islands and all that kind of stuff in 3 seconds, right? So who doesn't want to use a tool like that? Who doesn't want the computer to take that scope away? It obviously doesn't mean we want it to take it all away, right? And you want to use this tool just as another tool in your toolbox. Just that's what you do now, right? So I'm hoping that it takes over a lot of this scope a lot faster than we think. There's very deep implications into so many other avenues that, you know, go way beyond the drawing board, though. I mean, there's contracts, there's insurance, there's agencies, there's all of those things that are huge players, because architects have shied away from so much of that risk over time and given it away to these other things. And we're kind of waiting around for other people to tell us. I was speaking to a podcast guest for my show earlier today, and he did a deep dive into energy code across the United States and found out, to much to his dismay, that there are over 30,000 municipalities using a different variation of energy code. And so are these tools, can one tool solve for all of those constraints? No way. Right. And so then you start to step back and look at these larger problems. If we really wanted to get to model based delivery, and we really wanted to get to model based code check, so that we don't have to, you know, we can get 90% of the code check done without having to worry about it and really be able to trust it. These threads go so deep. And who should be solving those problems? Should we rely on municipalities? Should we rely on the federal government? I think there should be oversight there, but I think that we should own that. And so the real question then becomes, instead of working on architecture, how do we work on that stuff so that we can work on architecture? It is really a chicken and the egg problem.
Right, right. That makes sense. There was a comment that popped up. I think it was, actually a couple. I saw Tim commented and then Dawn commented, and they're in a similar vein, I think. But when we're talking about the parking lot layout popping up in 3 seconds, right? We may, back of house, we may have included 20 hours for that parking lot layout or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But now we have it in 3 seconds plus whatever it takes to actually customize that for the site. Tim's point is, client doesn't need to know how you get it done. Dawn's point is, they're going to keep, client, they are going to keep expecting more for less. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that idea? If as things get more efficient, if that's the right way to say it, I don't know that it is, but if with all of these tools, does the client then expect, hey, your fee on that last hospital was $150,000. I know you've got these tools. Your fee this time needs to be $100,000. Do you see that on the horizon because of this?
For sure.
But how would they ever know, though? How would they know unless?
Well, there are definitely are instances where you have to prove how much time you spent on various things, right? And so I know that there's large healthcare clients out there who, you have to itemize everything that you do. And so it just depends, right? And so is that going to happen? Yeah, that's going to happen. I guess you have to decide if that's the business that you want to be in or not. If you're selling time for money, then there's always going to be somebody who can do it in less time. But what is the value that you're providing? I'm sure that this has come up on Entre Architect Community and these podcasts over and over and over again, which is, what is the value proposition of architecture? What is a value proposition that you offer over a drafting service? What is a value proposition that your modeling does over drawing, right? So there's a lot going on there. I recognize that, but you have to show the value. And I think one of the things that we should be thinking of, instead of being just an early piece in the timeline of a project during the development of it and the synthesis of those ideas into something buildable, how do we stretch that out over a decade or two or three, right? And so if you actually have the tools that can provide the data about performance of a building, if that's what matters, or mental health of the occupants of a building, if that's what matters, for instance, right? Or environmental responsibility over time. How do you start to build that data into you helping your client operate their building better over the next two decades so that it achieves those goals and so that you can prove it? And maybe instead of getting paid just in the first 1 to 3 years of a project, you get paid over 30 years of a project and you have that relationship. And you're bringing value over a longer period of time. I think that there's other possibilities. And I saw this alarming statistic about this time last year, which was architects touch 1% of the world's built environment. 1%. And really? Who pays for that 1%? The 1%, right? The richest people in the world pay to build buildings, right? They're the ones who actually own and operate the buildings. So we do 1% for the 1%. What does that leave? We could continue to compete for less and less of that. We could continue to try to outdo our competitor by 1% or 2% or whatever in less time or for less cost. But it leaves 99% on the table. And I think we could probably all agree that the world needs more better architecture, and we need to touch a lot more people. There's living conditions out there that are absolutely abhorrent. Architecture would benefit that. And so instead of thinking of these projects as one-off, I really do feel like the technology is going to help us achieve scale in the types of projects that we can actually produce. They don't all have to be perfectly designed diamonds in the rough, right? We can do more at a lesser level because we have to do more of it and produce it at scale and really adopt pre-manufactured, modular, all of those things over stick-built construction that performs better over time. And there's still going to be special projects here and there, but I think that there's just so much that we leave on the table. If we kind of change our attitude and our perspective about what's available to us to be able to actually do and change the world, it's out there waiting for us, but we kind of choose to operate within this 1%.
So first of all, you're my hero. Second of all, there are people that hear me speak a lot in Entre Architect. They're probably thinking that I just paid you to talk so much about value. I didn't pay him.
No,
really smart. Waiting for that. Yeah. Checks in the mail. But I think what you're talking about there is exactly right. You know, in a way, you're talking about paradigm shift, right? Yeah. We have to think about things differently. One of the things that I wonder, you know, as we kind of swing towards the top of the hour here, who at this point, who is driving the change in the technology that we're using? And then the second part of that question is, who should be driving that, that change?
Yeah. So this was the twist, right? The twist was, the funny thing is, like, we're still just waiting around for technology companies or software developers to give us the tools to do the job. And for the most part, without our input. Now, of course, there's user groups and beta tests and all these things. And there's all kinds of surveys and things, but we're not directly involved in the creation of the tools that we use to produce our life's work, our career, everything that we do out there. And so I think that that's something that we have to, again, just take time away from doing the projects to wrangle ourselves and come together as a profession. And I don't know if the answer is the AIA. It typically isn't the answer. But if we are the AIA, if we are the profession, we have to take that responsibility on for ourselves to not only develop the tools, but to develop the standards to which we should all be held to. So it really comes down to that level of self-responsibility. And is that an easy problem? No, that is like a super wicked problem, right?
Right.
But yeah. I think we can all see what that could potentially look like. And I think we could all agree that there probably is a way to get there, but we all have to be willing to take part in that.
Right. Someone else was saying earlier, like how much resistance you actually get. You were talking about how people don't want to change. Mm-hmm. And less than 100, someone else said that 100, less than 100% commitment makes it a really difficult transition mm-hmm. to anything new. Right. So how do you get everybody on board with the idea? And how much resistance do you get? People wanted to know in your company, I guess, would reflect.
Yeah, lots of resistance. I mean, yeah, there people do struggle with change for sure, right? They struggle with it's kind of that fight or flight mentality, right? It's very much a feeling of potential obsolescence. But I think true leadership is enabling those under you to take your place, and if you can do everything you can to get out of their way, you are doing this profession a service. If you're doing everything you can to remove the red tape, I should say. I had a mentor, and it wasn't an architecture office. It was actually working at Apple, who said, you know, my job as your manager is to remove red tape and stay out of your way, because he saw that potential. And he saw my intrinsic motivation because I wanted to do big things. And that was the first time I'd ever actually seen leadership, is when somebody said that, because I think usually people are struggling to have ownership and authorship. They want to be the ones holding the pencil because they think that that's the most meaningful thing that they can do, is to be that author. But I think to really take a second look at that, take a hard look at that and say, how can I scale up? The only way to scale up is like, there's no clone machine for yourself, right? And if you're that person who can enact change or enable others to do it, that's what you have to take the responsibility to do and show that leadership. So I think working in firms, it is that selfless servant mentality that you have to use to enable others to do their best. That's the only way to actually scale this up, to get enough people involved to make a difference.
You know, I think as I'm sitting here listening, you know, so many great points and so much great conversation here. One of the things that strikes me, going back to what you just said a minute ago and talking about change, is that many, many architects, maybe they've never heard the idea of working on your business, not mm-hmm. in your business, or, you know, a large percent of the time. And I think that's one of the big issues. You know, there are a lot of people that, you know, whether AIA is a part of the conversation, not a part of the conversation, you know, clients are the reason, whatever. We have to, as a collective, we have to work on the business of architecture and mm-hmm. what you're talking about, some of these changes and some of the paradigm shifts that would have to happen, you know, even going back to the risk aversion of the profession and all those things that you talked about with contracts tied to, you know, the information, making it essentially, I guess, less risky. We've got to work on the business of architecture. And this is one of the playing fields, I think, that we have to get onto, is the technology playing field. You know, we've talked, and we talked offline about this as well. Neil Leach has written a couple of books on AI and architecture. He spoke to my pro practice class last semester, and I don't know why this surprised me, but he talked about the fact that what's going to cause architects to adopt AI is clients. It's going to be client demand for this.
Yeah.
And you said something, you know, earlier that struck me. It's, we can sit back and we can wait for someone to say, hey, I now require the deliverables to be this, or I now require this, or I want you to use this, or can we take control of it? Like you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know we haven't talked a lot about technology here, but in order to use that well and to use it effectively and to get to that point, I really do feel like there's kind of a reckoning of really foundational elements that have to be put in place rather than treating tech like it's a Band-Aid on top mm-hmm. of a already broken system.
Yeah.
Obviously we all practice in different ways. And those of us who are in 1 to 5 person firms, we're often working on residential projects and not hospitals and that sort of thing. But yeah. I mean, in my experience, my clients were the ones asking me ahead of me adopting a way for them to see it in 3D, like the BIM. They wanted to know if I could do that because they'd seen it on HGTV, which I know we're not supposed to bring up around here, but I mean, that's the reality. That's what they're watching, right?
And
that's
careful. What they want. You'll get canceled here. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what, in my experience anyway, my clients drove me to adopt that. Mm-hmm. And because I'm only one person, it was easy enough for me to change the culture of my firm to adopt it. So.
And it's never been easier to learn than it is right now, right? There's just so many resources out there. It doesn't mean you still have to wade through a bunch of crap, right? Mm-hmm. But there is some really good stuff. And one of the reasons in our digital practice at HMC, identified early on, and I think this really comes from my experience teaching, was like every school is teaching differently and they're not teaching technology. They're really leaving it up to the students to figure it out on their own. So they're watching a YouTube, they're watching LinkedIn Learning, they're picking up tips and tricks, and they're doing whatever works to get the deadline done. So they're coming to a firm with all of these really bad habits, right? Yeah. Like, that's just how it is. And I think the misconception is that firms hire students because they're whiz with technology. And the truth is, like, I want them to learn my way of doing it so that they do it the HMC way, right? So that if they drop off, somebody else can pick it up and know exactly where they are. Students can pick up any piece of software. They are like a sponge. It's native, right? That doesn't matter if they have skills already or not. So what we did was we created what we call our Digital Academy. And the goal of our Digital Academy, and I think this is pretty rare at a firm, like most firms don't do training at all because they think they're investing in somebody who's going to leave. And it's like, you know, the adage is, well, what if you don't and they stay, right? And then there's other ones who just rely on LinkedIn Learning or YouTube or whatever. And it's on you, nights and weekends. Good luck. I hope you can help us with our technology challenges, right? Yeah. We took the other point of view, which is we're going to create a group that will help raise the digital IQ of everybody in our company, because we're all in this together and it's our company, right? And we all want to be able to be more flexible and adaptive to projects. And we want to be able to have 3 people on this week and 7 people on the next week. And we want to be able to share work amongst our 350 locations, right? So how do we do that? Well, we have to have standards and stuff, but we also have to have everybody know the software at a certain level, and we have to come up together. So, and I realize like a lot of this stuff isn't for everybody in a firm. Like there was a comment earlier about, you know, you have a gift, you have a talent, you should use it. I totally agree. I'm not saying this is for everybody. I just think that there is a level of leadership that we see not happening in so many firms because everybody has their heads down and they're busy and they're not coming up for air and looking at that total landscape of where the heck are we going, right? It's like, it's not just where are we going today or tomorrow, but where are we going to be in 5 years? Even if it's wrong, how are we going to start to make moves to get there? So investing in your people, intentionally investing in your people is a huge way to help do that.
Yeah, because it's frustrating to try to change, learn a new program, even just on a basic level. And you want to go back to the old thing that you've always used. And so having that would be really helpful. Someone said
it is for some people, but there's other people who are just like, I can't wait to learn a new program. Right. So
right.
You can't treat everybody like, I think we've all been a victim of leadership that want, that somebody expects us to be just like them. Yeah. Right. So it's really about trying to find those goals and aspirations in everybody. And even though they're all going to be different, unlocking those so that they can really fly.
That's a really great point. And I think I was thinking about Catherine's comment a minute ago, you know, the HGTV, right, Catherine, mm-hmm. and this mm-hmm. is where your clients see it. Wouldn't it be great though, if we were thinking, how could I demonstrate this better? How could I help them understand this? You know, how could I
communicate?
Because that is what it comes down to, right? On every yes. level, right. it's all communication. Oh, for sure.
That's why it's such a great tool. And I try to tell people who don't want to pay, or they try to cut my fee by saying, I don't need the model. You can just show me the drawings. But I'm making the model anyway, so I refuse not to show them the model because that really does explain the project. And even for me, I love seeing it in 3D like that because it helps me understand it better than, and I can read plans perfectly well, of
Absolutely.
Course.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I would love to the idea of the goggles, the VR, the virtual reality goggles. Mm-hmm. And just sending them to someone. I mean, I guess now, since we don't really see them, when just do it all virtually. I mean, being able to inhabit the space. One of your recent podcasts, the person was talking about the disappointment of taking them off and being out. Like, the space is so real
that was
when
me.
It's on.
Yeah, that was yeah. me. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I mean, that's so true because I tried them on last summer, and I did. I was just kind of a little depressed when I took them off and had to give them to someone else who was their turn. And like, oh, that was so awesome in there.
Yeah.
So yeah. I feel like I think, you could give that experience to people. Like, it's so awesome, this new hospital or this new house right. or whatever.
Yeah, it's really inspiring. I think that's probably one of the best things about, you know, there's different modes you can work in VR. One is during design to help make decisions along the way. And the other part is the presentation part of it. I think they're both super valuable. And now with like an Oculus Quest 2 headset that you can just have sitting on your desk and you just pop it on and you can stay right where you are and you can jump into VR and you don't need any other special equipment. It's $299. It's not a big deal.
I'm buying one tonight then. That would be so much fun.
My mom got one for her birthday. Yeah. I mean, it's fantastic. Right. And so there's, because it has been democratized to that point, that it is a valuable tool on so many levels. The presentation side of it, to fully immerse people and put them in the driver's seat, it does two things. It lets them engage in a project. Like we said, when you take the goggles off, you're disappointed that you're back in your office. You actually are transported to that place. It is a phenomenal experience. And if you haven't, you can't judge it if you've never tried it, right?
True.
You have to try it. The second one is a lot of people, this is a side point, that a lot of people think that there's a guarantee I'm going to get motion sick, whatever. It's not going to happen. Like, for the most part, it is rock solid. There's a very small number of people now who actually get motion sick in VR. They finally figured it out. The other point that I really wanted to make, though, was that it forces an honesty upon the architect. You can no longer curate a single view. You can no longer Photoshop the HVAC units off of the building. You can no longer add the special lens flare and just get it exactly right and get the color temperature. Like,
that's true.
And but the beauty is, as an architect, you don't have to go to that level. People will accept it at a much lower level because it is a process and it doesn't have to be photoreal. And you can go into VR. And what I mean by it forces an honesty is it lets them look wherever they want to look. And so you have to build the whole thing.
Yeah.
So if they ask a question like, why is it like this? I mean, who better than to tell them why it's going to be like that than you? Right.
Right.
You're going to lead them through that. But it's an amazing way to communicate design. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And I know we could keep this conversation up for another hour. But I know some of you are going to want to or need to log off here in just a few minutes. So I do have one more burning question if Evan has another couple of minutes. But before that, for anybody that needs to wig out here in just a second, I want to, number one, thank you for being here. Thank you for being our audience and
great questions
and asking your questions and making your comments. That's what this is about. You know, this is a community and it's a conversation. So thank you for that. If this is your first time on a Context and Clarity Live, I want you to know that there are a couple of other things going on. Every morning, what is it, Catherine? 12:01 a.m. or something. The Context and Clarity Daily Podcast comes out every single day. So you get a review of the conversation from the day before and a preview of the conversation for that day. So you can find Context and Clarity, the podcast, wherever it is that you consume podcasts. So check that out. And if you want conversations like this every day, every weekday, inside the Entree Architect Community Facebook group, I host the Context and Clarity Conversations, 4 p.m. Eastern, every weekday. And tomorrow's topic, to give you a preview, is what's your go-to resource for recruiting new hires? So speaking of hiring young people who are digital natives, how do you find them? How do you hire them? So what is your resource for hiring new talent? So that's what we'll talk about as tomorrow's topic. So if you have to check out at this point, we understand. I hope you'll join me tomorrow inside the Entree Architect Facebook group for that conversation. Evan, have you got another minute?
Sure.
All right. I've got a question. You said, and Catherine highlighted this earlier in the conversation too, you said there's been more change in your firm over the last 18 to 24 months, even pre-COVID, pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. You also said that now you've got 350 or so individual offices. So that's a lot of change.
Yeah.
24, 18 months, a lot of change driven by global pandemic, et cetera.
Yeah.
What do you think? What's going to be the, and this is, you know, this is pie in the sky call for speculation, but okay. What do you think is going to be the next big thing that changes the way that we use technology, the way that we adapt technology? Do you see anything on the horizon where you say this is going to be a tipping point?
That's a great question. I think the thing that I think is going to change our profession, again, this isn't, man, it's so hard for me to stay in the technology realm, even though it's what I talk about all the time. Because of the remote nature of everybody working, and I'm sure that this is pretty typical in the Entree Architect community where there's a lot of shared resources, people doing different stuff, working with a lot of different people, a lot of onesies and twosies out there who are able to, you know, my wife actually does that in the next room over. She works for, you know, 5 different architects and builds models for them and stuff. Talent is going to really shift location because it is decoupled from location now.
Yeah.
And so we're going to see a huge change, I think, in where talent migrates, and that's going to change how people approach project work. Because I think the best firms out there are going to be fully remote. And I know that there's, and I believe it myself, that working together collaboratively is how architects need to work. But I think that that's all going to be changing with new platforms and new tools that are out there. There's one, for instance, called TeamFlow. If you go to teamflow.com, I think that's what it is, or TeamFlow HQ, something like that, where they've actually added like a spatial layer to online meetings. And they also take away like the scheduling aspect of it. So right now, like our firm, 350 people, you have to schedule every time you want to have a call with somebody, right? So how do you learn through osmosis as an emerging professional from a senior project architect anymore? Are you just going to call them up, or are you going to feel like you're intruding? Right. And I think a lot of people do feel like they're intruding when they're actually making a phone call nowadays, whether before, like everybody knew, I would just call and the phone would ring and they would either pick it up or they wouldn't, which is obviously still the case. But I think there's this extra layer of like, I'm intruding on people because we all know what it's like in this environment. We are on the calls all day long, every single day. Like that's what it's like. So this TeamFlow company, and there's several others out there as well, have kind of taken this approach of open office, but it's a digital office. Mm-hmm. And you can go into rooms and have private conversations, and it's kind of proximity based. So you can, as you get closer to somebody, you can hear them. And as you move away from somebody, you don't hear them anymore. And rooms have persistent media. So you can throw up a document in a room and you can throw up a whiteboard in a room. And when you come back to that room the next day, that stuff is still there, just like a real office, right? Instead of having to start from scratch with a new Zoom call every day. That's, so,
Evan, I'm sorry, does that exist right now, or you're saying that should exist? Does it?
It does. Yeah. The Team Flow company, and there's several others out there who are doing that. And they, some are in various states of beta, but they're trying to onboard and scale up as fast as they can, because they know there's a huge need for this, right? If I'm an emerging professional and I want to hang out in a lounge on my computer while I'm drawing in Revit, so that I can overhear the conversation where my senior project manager is yelling at a contractor about something, I should be able to hear that. I'm going to learn a lot from that, even though it's not my conversation, which is what everybody experienced in an office before this.
Yeah.
So you start to couple that with a remote company that can be anywhere, and you start to, I think, once again, realize why you work with the people that you work with. Right. Because I think a lot of people are like, why do I work with all these people? If we don't have to be in the same location, if my office can be anywhere, who do I want to work with? And you want to work with the best people, and you want to work with people who are going to help you advance your career and continue your trajectory, not just pigeonhole you into doing the same thing over and over again because you're really good at it. So all that to kind of go back to the beginning statement about remote companies. If remote companies attract the best talent, then companies who stay local are only going to get the B and C talent, because those are the talent that's going to be near them if they're going to force people to come into the office and do that. It doesn't solve all the problems. I just think this is a general topic. It's something that I'm kind of watching, but I think it's going to be an important one for us to keep our eye on. Is this pandemic, this catastrophe, is forcing us to hopefully rethink why we do the work that we do, who we work with and for, and where that can happen. If we can start to decouple what we do with location and time, we're going to see a huge migration in people working around. And I think that's going to fundamentally change the way that we practice, because companies are going to be forced to change. And we all know that that's kind of the only way companies actually change.
Yeah, that's true.
Is if they're forced to.
Yeah.
Well, there's never waste a good. What they say, never waste a good catastrophe.
Yeah. That's a really. I'm going to have to check out Team Flow.
That's amazing.
That sounds really interesting. And that's that is
solving a real problem.
Years ago, in the 90s, when I was in graduate school, we would talk about who's going to be designing these online spaces when online stuff spaces were just starting. And so it's a subject that's been going, around for a long time. So I'm amazed that something like that exists. So I'm going to definitely look that up.
Yeah. And it's not, it's kind of video game like, kind of Zoom and Teams like, kind of whiteboard like, it's kind of got this special incantation of all those different things into one platform. So I'm hoping the best for it, because I think it's going to be a game changer for, especially for creative professions like ours, where people do need to collaborate and work together to get to the best solutions. So
we've been doing some collaborating here, just informally on Zoom, working together, just sitting there working at the same time together. And I wonder if something like this, where people just go there to work, like we used to go to work at the library, you just be around people and ask questions when they came up.
Right.
And to me, that's like a game changer right there. So takes me out of my little basement.
And I wonder too, to that point, Catherine, there was I think it was yesterday, I was reading an article that another one of the big co-working conglomerates filed for bankruptcy protection. So they're, they're kind of falling off the cliff for obvious reasons. Does this become the new co-working model?
Yeah, I think one of the issues that like a firm like ours is going to see is, when there is a shift back toward a hybrid model of some people work from home some days of the week and go into the office some days of the week, and 350 schedules are clashing, right? The people who do stay home are still going to be kind of a level below of citizenship, right? Because they're not there in person. And so you really need something that one beautiful thing about the pandemic is it totally leveled the playing field. Everybody's an equal citizen when it comes to meetings and voice. As long as you're willing to speak up and ask a question or talk about something, you have the exact same platform that everybody else does, where I think we all know instances before where three of us were in a conference room and one person wasn't. And that one person who wasn't in the conference room never spoke up. That's going to happen again if we don't actively try to figure out how to solve that issue.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, again, why I think these fully remote companies are going to do a little bit better, is because it just is the same playing field for everybody.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that brings up a whole nother topic. we could keep going with this for hours. So, but we probably shouldn't. So, Evan, thank you.
Thank you. It was great.
This conversation. Thanks for sharing all of your wisdom. Yeah, absolutely. This is Evan Troxell, co-founder, co-host of ArcSpeak Podcast, also the host of the Troxell Podcast. He is the director of digital practice at HMC Architects. And one thing I didn't mention at the beginning, I should have done this, I forgot about it, but next week, it's interesting how when we plan out all of these shows, next week our theme is really around startup, licensure, ARE, et cetera. And Evan is the author of ARE Hacks. It would have been great to have brought that up at the beginning of this conversation, but maybe we'll get you in one of these conversations next week at some point. But thanks, Evan. Really appreciate you being here. And Catherine, thank you for doing this again. Mm-hmm. We'll do it again. Catherine and I will do this again next week. For those of you who have joined us for the first time, again, thank you for being here. Thank you for being a part of this conversation. We'll do this exact same format again next week, Thursday, 4 p.m. Eastern, across all the internet, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitch, and YouTube. And we'll have Ryan Willard, who is the host of Business of Architecture UK. He's an architect over in London. He'll be our guest. So look out for us and Ryan next week. And then again, if you are part of the Entree Architect community, if you're an architect, if you're not part of the Entree Architect Community Facebook group, you should go over there. Join the group. If you're not a Facebook person, that's all right. I'm not either. The only thing I do on Facebook is the Context and Clarity conversations on a daily basis there. And there's a link, entrearchitect.com/group, will take you directly to the Facebook group, and you won't have to see any other part of Facebook. So if that's what's holding you back, entrearchitect.com/group. Go straight into the group. Join this conversation tomorrow. We're going to talk about resources to find and hire new talent. So check that out, if you will. And again, thank you to all of you in the audience. I know that your time is valuable. I know you're busy. You've taken you've invested an hour of your time on this conversation. I really appreciate that. So we'll be back here again tomorrow. 4 p.m. Eastern, same bat time, same bat channel, 4 p.m. Eastern, inside the Entree Architect Community Facebook group. I hope you'll join me then. Until then, please take care of yourself. Take care of those around you. Still a crazy world out there. We want to keep everybody safe and well. Take a little bit of time to breathe and relax. Come back again tomorrow rejuvenated and ready to get back at it. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks.
Bye.
If you want more of the Context and Clarity podcast delivered to you every weekday, subscribe wherever you consume podcasts. And if you love content like this, check out Gable Media. It's the multimedia network for people that care about the built environment, and it's the home of Context and Clarity. With Gable's growing family of podcasts and video channels, I know you'll find something there that interests you. You can learn more at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. So thanks for listening. I hope our time together has inspired you to think about your community and your practice and how you can support those around you. I'll be back here again tomorrow. And in the meantime, I hope you'll join me and the Entree Architect community on Facebook. The link is entrearchitect.com/group. That's where every weekday at 4 p.m., I host Context and Clarity Conversations. And we take these topics, the topics that you hear about in this daily podcast episode, and we dig deeper. We have a conversation in real time so we can help each other find more clarity around the topics that matter most, no matter what your context is.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.